women don't support other women. And I still hear that over and over and over.
Welcome to Reimagining You. Today, my guest is someone who hasn't just studied women's leadership, she's helped define it. Sally Helgeson has spent decades elevating the conversation around inclusion, ambition, and what it really takes for women to rise. What's the personal mission that kept you grounded all these years?
It's really been about 40 years, and the mission has been consistently the same. I've been able to pursue that mission in many different kinds of ways.
And we try a lot of times to include female, whether it's in the field, whether it's in the office, whether it's management. And just the attractability is not there.
What research shows is that decision-making is better on teams and units and divisions when you have a balance of men and women.
Is women handle pressure better than men in a workplace environment?
They often get dismissed as too emotional. Generally, I have seen happen is when there's a lot of pressure, men fall into line.
How did it come by that you started thinking about that subject and build that credibility?
My mission as a writer is making complicated ideas simple. That's simple. It. And I think that simplifying ideas is really one of the ways of showing empathy for an audience. You don't want them to have to work too hard. You did the work, figure it out. Now let them enjoy the fruits of that.
Welcome to Reimagining You, the podcast where we unpack personal brand, reinvention, and leadership with the people rewriting the rules. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Daher, and today my guest is someone who hasn't just studied women's leadership, she's helped define it. Sally Helgeson has spent decades elevating the conversation around inclusion, ambition, and what it really takes for women to rise. From her groundbreaking book, The Female Advantage, to the global bestseller, How Women Rise with Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, Sally has not only opened doors, she's shown women how to walk through them with purpose, presence, and power. So, Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Eli. It's wonderful to be with you.
The pleasure is ours. Before we start, Sally, I wanted to take a moment to go back to something pivotal, somewhere late 2019. You were leading a 90-minute workshop on women's leadership, expecting a room full of women. But to your surprise, nearly about 70 or 73% of attendees were men. And you were intrigued. And when you asked why, the answer was powerful. I think one man said, "Please don't waste your time telling us why we need to get better at this. We get it. We understand. What we don't know is how to do it. We don't have a clue." Yes. And that moment, I think, so revealing, exposed a major gap in how we talk about inclusion, right? The lack of clear, actionable guidance. And instead of just identifying the problem, you wrote Rising Together, right? A book that doesn't just talk about diversity, it equips people like me and others to actually build inclusive behaviors across gender, race, and generations. Does this fair? Is this fair description?
This is an exactly fair description. It was so fascinating because it was out at in Las Vegas, and it was called the Construction Super Conference. So there were a lot of men at this conference. And it was really interesting to me because I realized we were in new territory. I'd been talking about doing programs on leadership seminars, et cetera, about women as leaders for, at that point, 30 years. And what was, and it, they were always asking me to build a business case. Well, what what data do you have that show the organization is more profitable with, et cetera, like that. The business case was built, you know, by Catalyst at Felice Schwartz back in the early 90s. But they still wanted, that's what they were interested in. So it was fascinating to hear this man say, what we need to know is how. And I got very excited because I've always felt that all the inclusion initiatives, et cetera, were too focused on unconscious bias rather than on behaviors, which are more easily perceived by people. So I thought, thank you for this idea. I am going to address the how in my next book, which was Rising Together, by focusing on behaviors.
Wonderful, wonderful. Let's talk about mission. You know, in my personal branding book, I speak about 10-step process, but everybody, every executive, man or woman or gender neutral, wanted to start, discover their brand or build their brand. They have to start with a mission, right? For you, you have spent decades helping women redefining leadership. But what's the personal mission that kept you grounded all these years? I mean, how has this mission evolved or simply deepened?
It's really been about 40 years, and the mission has been consistently the same. And it is to help women to recognize, articulate, and act on their greatest strengths, and to help organizations go through the kind of cultural changes required to be able to recognize the contributions, the distinctive contributions that women can make. So that's been consistent. It's been aimed at women, it's been aimed at organizations, and it hasn't really changed. Yes, it has deepened, and yes, I've been able to pursue that mission in many different kinds of ways, in terms of women's vision, in terms of women's strengths, in terms of in how women rise, what gets in women's way. That's been consistent.
So the second step in the mission, after the mission, is really your edge, or what makes you credible, develop the authority on speaking about women leadership, about inclusion. So you were writing about inclusion long before it was even mainstream. I'm going to ask you before we go to your authority, what's one perspective or idea that you held early on that the world is only now catching up to?
The perspective that I held early on, and which was did not really break through for a while, was that women and also other outsiders to the mainstream leadership of the organization often have distinctive gifts. With women, these include, you know, skillful relationship building, a bias toward direct communication, knowing in their bones the kind of value that diverse people and outsiders can bring to an organization because they themselves know what they have to bring. Many, many different talents. But what struck me, and this struck me in the late 1980s, is that these talents, these skills, which were not really considered leadership skills back then. In fact, if you talked about relationship building, they say, oh, those are soft skills. Those aren't leadership skills. Oh, yeah. But that they are particularly needed in today's organizations because of the nature of the knowledge economy, where people have to be motivated from their hearts in order to give their best ideas. And the organization is dependent, far more dependent on the knowledge of their people than they are on the value of the, you know, of the machines that they have because of the falling costs of technology. And also in a global economy where you have highly diverse workplaces everywhere. This is not, you know, people in the U.S. think this is a U.S. thing. No, the world and you see it's not.
It's not. I worked in 4 continents, 12 different countries. You know, I come from an oil and gas background, right? I lived 27 years in all over the place. And it's man dominant industry, right? And we try a lot of times to really get to include female in, whether it's in the field, whether it's in the office, whether it's management. And just the attractability is not there, right? So whatever you could try, there are still some industries that it's not there at attracting. However, I think the benefit is tremendous. And every Sunday, I meet with my friends over coffee. This is our Sunday ritual. And I was mentioning last Sunday that I was going to talk to you today. And we start debating, you know, what's Sally's angle? What does she talk about? And we talked about the women leadership. And we start debating. And actually, you know, we feel that there is a lot of value of having women, more empathy in the workplace, maybe decision-making is better decision-making, maybe more logical process and thinking. What do you think the balance that women bring in? And I'm sure you've done a lot of research and studies around that.
Well, I do think the decision-making, what research shows is that decision-making is better on teams and units and divisions when you have a balance of men and women. That the decision-making, the pool of ideas that get thought about and the considerations that are made are much broader. So you make better decisions. Surprisingly, it also finds that teams are more harmonious when they have a better balance between men and women. So there are lots of advantages. It's amusing you bring that up about, for me, about the oil and gas field, because I'm very familiar with it. I've spent a lot of time working in it. And in fact, my first book, which had nothing to do with women, this is over 40 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
Almost 50, was about independent oil producers in the U.S., Texas specifically, and their efforts to go international, the contracts they held off the Sinai Peninsula. It was just a fascinating world, and they gave me tremendous access to it. And but there were no women then. This was in the mid-late 70s, there were no women in it at all. So it gave me my background in business and organizations and got me really fascinated on that topic. But it was an unusual first book for someone who then made their their name within women's leadership.
Okay, interesting. So one more item there I'm thinking about, which is... what about working under pressure? I think that was one item that came up as well during our discussion. I think, is women handle pressure better than men in a workplace environment?
I think they can at times. You know, they often get dismissed as too emotional, as you know, I'm sure you've heard that one. And there often is a certain passion that comes through, and they may need to be, you know, persuaded in a different kind of way that an idea is good. But again, that speaks to better decision making. And I think the feeling of under pressure, what generally I have seen happen is when there's a lot of pressure, men fall into line and go along with whoever the top dog is. That's just a way of not only taking the pressure off, but having plausible deniability afterwards. Well, he made the decision, you know, he's a boss. But women are less likely to do that. They're more likely to continually advocate. So I think that sometimes they may not be feeling the kind of pressure, but it will manifest differently. And that can be harder for men to deal with. Not saying that's true in all cases, but boy, I did a lot of work with Chevron, for example. And I remember the woman who was the manager of their whole Kazakhstan gas discovery. And this, she was very good at dealing with pressure, but she had real personality about it. She wanted to hear what everybody had to say.
Okay. All right. Well, you can tell that this subject of women, men is always, fascinating, and, you know, it fills the room and it consumes hours and hours of discussions. But today is really about personal brandings, about you, your journey, and our audience and viewers, what can they learn from your journey? So appreciate that. The second item after the mission is really your edge or your authority. Obviously, you've got work for 40 years or four decades around women leadership. So that you can probably, I'm sure you can claim authority and credibility on that field, correct? I mean, I'm looking at other people, like typically executives, which is most of the audience and viewers.
Yes.
they're thinking of, okay, I live in a comfort trap. I'm living in that side of the world with my business card, my title, and a nice company name with some perks. I'm comfortable. But then when I leave that place, I become a PIP, a previously important person, right? and then I start struggling. I have liabilities, I have family, I have kids, I've got responsibilities. I'm stuck. So my advice to them always is build your personal brand while you're working. You have a lot of value. You have a lot of knowledge. Put it out. And typically people stay in their lane. They swim in their lane. And if they're in this industry or in this function, they build momentum. They go out in the open and claim thought leadership into that and make it visible. Now, for you, started 40 years ago, how did it come by that you started thinking about that subject and build that credibility?
I think I realized early on that I had to build credibility. It had to some degree to do with making a shift from being just a writer, as I thought of it, to also being delivering programs, what we now call master classes, seminars, et cetera, on women's leadership, mainly with women in organizations or in associations, but also for companies. So there would be men there and they would try to, you know, I would try to convey an idea of the value that existed in terms of their women. So I had to make that shift and I had to figure out how to get that voice on the page, which I would spend a lot of time working to make as clear and as simple as possible. That's always been sort of my mission, if you will, as a writer, is making complicated ideas simple. That's simple. It. So you have to dig down a lot and
for really, us to understand it.
Yeah, work on clarity. Work on being as concise as you can while keeping the impact. So that's what I knew how to do as a writer. You know, I've been writing since I was a teenager. But to convey that in a voice, speaking, and to learn to facilitate and engage with groups was a challenge at the start for me. And what I realized is that I had to use that sort of that same process, which is to focus on making the ideas simple and making them as practical as possible for the audiences that I had. And that if I could focus on that, not dumbing ideas down at all, because that is, you know, comes off immediately as condescending. And I think that simplifying ideas is really one of the ways of showing empathy for an audience. You know, you don't want them to have to work too hard. You did the work, figure it out. Now let them enjoy the fruits of that. So that was what my challenge was. And once I realized, excuse me, that the process that had served me in writing and the goals of clarity and simplicity and practicality would be the same, then I was able to sort of establish a more holistic or cohesive is really brand, because that's what I heard from people. Oh, I know the voice in your books. It's the same voice that you have when you speak. And that was very gratifying to me because it showed me I was on the right track. So it's really a focus on audiences and trying to help them get as clear as we could.
Okay. We before the show we were talking about the digital space and the non-digital space. I come from the knowledge economy. I assume you do the same. You are coming from the same knowledge where. We studied, we amassed knowledge in school, university, workplace, and we part knowledge, we share, we train, we mentor, we apply. Today, we have an attention economy that is now in the make, right? all the content online, the social media, people consume content. So we're at the intersection between a knowledge economy and the creator economy or the attention economy. So I call it a hybrid economy.
That's good.
Okay. So you like books, you still publish books, you write books and become bestsellers. I'm on my second book. I just published it. But where do you think the role of the book is, or where is it going to be? I mean, we're still going to publish books and print them. What do you think of the transformation to the hybrid or even the attention economy? And how well are we going to be impacted with?
Well, books, I mean, you know, people send me their books on leadership for, you know, just to keep me in the loop or because I've given an endorsement. And I will tell you that I get 10 or 12 books a week. So it is, I don't see it as going away. It is foundational content. That's what you have there. It's content that you are required to really think through so that it is, in that thinking through process, it comes to have great value. This doesn't mean it's the only way to do it, but that gives a person foundational content that they can use in so many different ways, in programs, in virtual programs. You know, Marshall has that Marshall bot. That, you know, a lot of that, what he conveys in that comes from that foundational work he did with Mark in writing those books, especially What Got You Here Won't Get You There and Triggers. But I think that it will not go away now. Will books all be, you know, printed, or will they be, you know, in various forms that we read on the internet? I can't predict that. I have noticed that even independent bookstores are coming back. So I don't see it as disappearing, but I see it as in some ways being almost more powerful than it has been traditionally, because it has more ways to reach bigger and broader audiences. You know, you have 10,000 women in Bangalore that you're talking to in an event that has all kinds of technology bells and whistles, because they're, you know, young women who are from the continent of India. They are really early adapters. But what you're sharing ultimately comes down to what you have processed and refined and developed by writing a book.
Okay. Well said. I mean, I'm definitely, it'll be always a reference. It'll be a foundation, as you said, foundational knowledge. Talking about Marshall's bot, and I did tell him that I wake up every morning on this MarshallGoldsmith.ai and I listen to his voice giving me three thoughts. It's like his father, the fatherly figure telling me, son, do this, you know, three things every day. So, I mean,
exactly.
It's amazing and I love it.
Yeah, people love that. People love that. And what's fascinating about those kinds of things, you know, when we were in the early age of you know, digital tech, people would say high tech or high touch. It combines it now. That's what you're really beginning to see. And people who use MarshallBot, for example, feel very, very connected to that and connected to him in a way. And that's true in all kinds of things. I did my recordings for the, you know, the audiobooks have been very, very successful. And what I get is people say, I feel like I know you. I feel like I know you. And in fact, Ellie, this was interesting because my work was in person. You know, I did events in person and I didn't like webinars. I thought they were boring. But when we had to switch in the pandemic, I found a very interesting thing, which was that before, when I do talks, keynotes, whatever it was, people would come up to me and afterwards say, you're such a skillful speaker and stuff like that. Well, I've been doing it a long time. But when we switched to this, people would write and say, I feel like I know you. And I think it was because you have your head right there, you know, and it's often full screen. And that gives people a feeling of intimacy. So there's a lot of, I think, intimacy that comes through in some of these media that isn't really acknowledged or talked about.
Great, great. So for our viewers and audience, really, use the medium, but use multiple channels, right? So you're going to write, you're going to author, whether it's a book, an article, an editorial, whatever, put your thoughts out there, put your, you know, claim your thought leadership, whether on paper, whether online, digitally, or in conferences, but get it out there, claim that space. Yeah. You've got a lot of value to give. Give it, share it, and tell the world about it, right? So,
yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's it. It's a much better era, I can say that.
Yes. It disseminates the information much faster, much quicker. The problem is decipher the noise from the true thoughts, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about your trips to various countries, working with leaders in 37 countries. You just mentioned India. How do you manage? I mean, well, not manage, but what do you, when you go and do a workshop or you do a speech or you do any kind of event, do you see cultural differences in how the knowledge or your thought process that you have developed in the US when you go to Asia or South Asia or the Middle East, do they differ? Did you see clashes? Did you see commonalities? How do you manage all this?
The commonalities have always and continue to take my breath away. When we wrote How Women Rise, my concern was that it would be perceived of as behaviors, you know, it's about behaviors that get most likely to get in the way of successful women, that it would be perceived of as behaviors most likely to get in the way of successful American women, even though I had drawn examples from around the world from programs that I'd done. But for example, when I did the launch for the Japanese edition, I went over there and spent a week in Japan doing programs. And the most common response I got was this: we thought only Japanese women had these behaviors. We didn't know other women did. I have had a variation on that. And the extraordinary thing, and especially with this book, because we sold in 26 languages, so it had that big impact, and I had the opportunity to do a lot of in-person and virtual work, ranging from Brazil to Turkey to India and China, et cetera. And obviously Japan, Korea, whatever. It's been quite remarkable. But that is how it got picked up. So what I have always tried to do, because my work has been fairly global from the start, because I had a lot of publications in different languages, never 26, is that I try not to really think about or overemphasize cultural differences, but really focus on, you know, what is human? What experiences have we shared? We may have had different experiences in terms of the details, but the impact is often the same, that impact on us as human beings. So that's what I try to focus on. And I think that interestingly, a lot of, you know, colleagues I've had who've talked about, I'm so nervous, I've got to do this thing in, you know, Shanghai, I don't know how this would be received, et cetera. They're focusing on cultural difference, not commonality. And they also want, in a very explicit way, to be seen as empathic with the local situation. But I think the way you get, I mean, I know this from personal experience, the way you are perceived of as empathic is because what is true in the deep kernel of what you're sharing is true for humans. So that's what people pick up on. Whereas trying to parse the cultural differences and, you know, obviously you want to be aware of the political situation, et cetera, without addressing it. But that I think that does not come off as empathic. It comes across as what it is thinking about difference, not thinking about, you know, a similarity, commonality.
Okay, that's interesting because, you know, if I, you know, I worked in various countries as well, and the issues that I see is that, and that's why I asked you, you come from North America. People or leaders come from North America to do workshops in, let's say, sales in the Middle East or selling in Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, right? The dynamic of selling, the dynamic of conversation is completely different.
Yes.
You know, it's not confrontational. You have to sit in majlis. You have to, you know, earn the trust, warm up the relationship, and then you evolve. So a lot of companies that I've seen, they actually bring in speakers, workshop leaders from North America to conduct those workshops. Yet maybe to find out there's a lot of nuances that the person who's coming from overseas does not really appreciate that or have not had the time to study. Obviously, this is not your case. You worked in 37 countries, and you just mentioned there's a lot of commonalities around women, right? But in terms of sales, even in terms of decision making, I mean, I quote my friend Erin Mayer, where she did the cultural map, right?
Yes.
With all the seven different dimensions, and every nationality have a different approach to all these different dimensions. Unless you really understand, and I give always the question, if a British person says, this is interesting, what does it mean to you as a different national than the UK?
Yeah.
If you're from Southeast Asia, what does it mean? If you're from Germany, what does it mean? If you're from the US, what does it mean? Is he interested? Did he discount the idea? What does he mean or she means, right? So these nuances, unless you really experience those and understand and appreciate this, you cannot relate to the other countries. That's really why my question is in terms of countries and cultures.
I understand that. Maybe the work I do is different because it's so personal to people, and we have those commonalities. But I think in terms of this, the cultural differences, the key and fundamental value there has got to be respect. And because of a lot of cultural factors, Americans often abroad do not come off as respectful. They just don't. I mean, I traveled a lot, and I see it. So that's what makes the difference. Is not, we don't have to know all the difference. We don't have to go in there with a, I mean, her map is fantastic, but we don't have to go in there, you know, Japanese are this and they do this. And yes, bring your cards if you're going to Japan, obviously, business cards, they're useless here. But I think it's just feeling respect and curiosity about someone's culture. So understanding, like your thing about what does it mean if you say it's interesting, then you can always just say, what is it that intrigues you about this idea? And then that will give you more of a clue as to what they mean.
Of course.
So just don't go in there assuming that what something means to you is always going to be the same thing. Be curious and be very respectful of everyone.
Very well said. Very well said. Thank you so much. This is to the point. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Let's talk about content, right? And obviously, you've got a lot of wealth of knowledge and information in these books, and also with you, and you're happily passing it on through your trips, your workshops. But there must be an idea that you've repeated for years that people still resist hearing. What could it be?
I think the idea that I've been repeating for years that people still resist hearing is the notion that women and other, you know, outsiders to the leadership mainstream have a lot to bring, particularly given the nature of a global, interconnected, technology-rich, and knowledge-centric economy. And I don't think that idea has gotten the traction that I've been trying to bring to it for many, many, many decades, that there's this confluence, this fortunate confluence between relationship building, you know, direct communication, bringing your whole self to work. There's a confluence between that and what people who have been, you know, who've had to struggle to get into leadership positions and who've kind of seen, you know, ways it's been done very traditionally that they perhaps don't think are that great. So I think that that insight, there's one other thing, though, that I've been fighting against a long time, although it was to some degree somewhat true back 40 years ago, which is that women don't support other women. And I still hear that over and over and over. Wow. I do not find it to be true. I don't find men terribly supportive of one another if they're outside their networks. And it, you know, it's just a kind of myth out there that women do not support other women. And I hear it a lot, and I always try to push back against it. Not my experience.
Okay. Good observation. So you think they are really supportive?
Yes, I do. I do. You know, and then what the research shows is that the more women there are in an organization, on a team, in a field, the more supportive they are, which makes sense. There's less of a feeling of scarcity, that only one is going to be chosen.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Thanks for the insight. So we talked about mission. We talked about credibility. We talked about tone of voice, how to go to the open. You know, obviously, is it digital? Is it content on paper in conferences? We talked about the culture and going out and, you know, sensitivity to cultures, adaptability, understanding the culture and curiosity, genuine curiosity, and most importantly, respect of the cultures. Now, taking it one notch down in the process, are we going to talk about taking the stand, presenting, taking the stage, owning the room? I mean, we've done it millions of times. But for our audience and viewers, maybe this is their first time or they get those stage fright. What's your reset button before you take the stage? And how do you stay calm? How do you be relaxed? Give us some tips.
First of all, I focus on my breathing beforehand, because that's, and Marshall does this too. You have to breathe. You have to smile. You have to do that at the very start. That will relax and calm you, and it will engage you. So that's number one. For myself, when I, as I'm going into a room, I look around the room, I look around the audience, and I think, some of these people are going to hear something today that is really important to them. So then that gives me a feeling of impact before I go into the room. And I really ask a blessing on everyone in the room, rather than, oh God, please make me good. You know, it's like, let these people, you know, I wish the best for them, on everybody in the room. So those things tend to relax me. I've learned a lot over the years, because I've made every mistake. I've bombed. I've been a dud. It's happened. You know, it's and those things you learn from, you know, you really learn from them. And for me, what has been most problematic is this desire to, not desire, because, but this compulsion to over-prepare. And when I over-prepare, I kind of work myself into a state where I'm not going to connect with the audience. Okay. But, you know, the other thing is, you can always, the reset, when you perceive that people are not engaged, it's really important. You know, sometimes if you're not experienced, you think, oh no, they don't like me. You know, okay, fine. What you want to do at that moment is to say, you know, how is this? Is this working for you? Is this helpful in your specific situation? Is there a way it could be more helpful, what I'm saying, in your specific situation? Okay. And if nobody raises their hand, because they're like, you know, they don't want to do that because they don't want to sound like they're contradicting the speaker. So you can call on people and say, how about you? Stand up, tell us how this how this resonates with your experience.
And engage the audience.
Yeah, just do that and engage them in a way that's not critiquing you, but adding things that you can then build on that may be better for them. Because your information coming in about what they need is sometimes quite wrong. You've received it through a bias filter. You've received it through you know, the head of the HR who wants them to resonate with certain things, but they don't. You know, that's not to beat up on head of HR, but we all have our objectives, and the people in the audience don't necessarily go along with that.
Powerful tips. Powerful tips. I mean, breathing, staying calm, gauging the room, looking at the room, understanding that people there is to, you know, take something and benefit from that. I think this is powerful. No, I think Marshall did say that as well. If I can contribute a small idea to a person that could change his life or her life, this is a mission accomplished, right? I mean, he's not going to change the world, but one piece at a time, which is great. Also, when you gauge the room and you see people not really engaged, you know, approach them, talk to them, clarify and see how you can fine-tune. This is absolutely great. But you mentioned that you've done some bombs there, here and there, and you bombed meetings and whatever. So tell us some, you know, an instance maybe, if you can recall, when you lost it in a room.
Well, you may have read in the opening of How Women Rise, I talked about how Marshall and I were co-presenting at, it was actually a women's leadership conference at a major military hardware supplier. And I was nervous about it. I was nervous to be presenting with him. This is about 15 years ago, maybe 20. And so I got to my hotel room early and I had dinner in my room. I had some friends there in the town we were presenting in. But I had dinner in my room and went over my notes and, you know, updated and updated. I think it was a 3-hour conversation. And you know, I was quite uptight, and Marshall was coming in very late, so we all met in the lobby. He'd forgotten his pants, so we had to drive around, and he was wearing cutoff jeans. We had to drive around and find some pants for him, and then we got to the event, and he, you know, fell down when he was coming out of the men's room, and it was just, it was kind of a disaster, but he was so there. He was having a blast. He wasn't worried. He wasn't nervous, and he wasn't so sticking to his notes. I was sticking to my notes because I felt like I had to get all my content in and share it and all this sort of stuff. And then toward the end, he said, oh, he had a beeper. This shows you how long ago it was. He said, oh, I just got a note. My flight is at a different time than I thought it was. Sorry, I got to leave. You're in Sally's capable hands. He left. They gave him a standing ovation. So I soldiered on and got through everything and felt, you know, very responsible. And I got nice applause. And I thought, okay, this clearly, I need to learn from this. And what I realized really is that I was demonstrating what a stressed out, somewhat nervous woman in a good position looked like. And they already knew that from their own experience. They wanted to enjoy themselves. They wanted to have a good time in addition to learning, as Marshall says, that one thing that they take away, because people usually only take away one thing. So I thought, you know, the biggest mistake I made was probably staying in my hotel room last night. If I'd gone out, had a wonderful Italian meal in Providence, Rhode Island, which there are a lot of them there, it would have gone differently. So it was a big learning from me. I felt like I was a bomb. I wasn't, you know, really a bomb, but I didn't, you know, the audience didn't resonate so much with me and how I was delivering.
Fascinating, fascinating. That's a good story, and it's in your book.
Yeah,
it is. The beginning of the book, hilarious. Then we go further into the 10-step process. We talked about now owning the room. We're going to talk about networking.
Yes. Right?
So once you know, you have to build your network. And typically people, our audience and viewers, executives, they go to trade shows, even they go to conferences or even within their social network, right? And you present your business card, either digitally nowadays or physically, like in Japan and other countries. And then a person that is receiving, on the receiving end, reads the card and asks you, what do you do? Or you ask him or her, what do you do? And if they tell you, well, I work doing this for that company, and if you don't see and feel that the person is interesting for you, or you're going to get something out of him or her, typically you say, well, pleasure meeting you, and then you move on to another person so you can walk the room. And that's how most of the corporate world have been taught, right? You move on, you work the room, and see who could be useful for you. Until I met on one of the podcast sessions or episodes, Adrian Gostick, which you know.
Of course. Right?
And he had changed my perspective. He says, well, people that are great networkers, they reflect on you when you're talking and describing what you do is, what can I do to help you, rather than take from you? So I think about things that I could propose. Maybe I connect you to this person, or I can guide you to this place, or I can give you an idea or a thought. And then if you like that, you might do reciprocally and then, you know, do the same for me. And that has changed my philosophy on networking. Now, what is yours in networking, particularly around women in leadership, where really in the rooms that it's not built really for women in mind sometimes?
Two things. First of all, one of my core beliefs is that everybody is interesting. It's just you haven't asked them the right questions. And okay. I think these events where you, what do you do, is kind of an intrinsically uninteresting question with most people. You know, if you do something like, you know, women's leadership and I write books and do programs, people are interested. But if you, you know, you say I'm the head of accounting for whatever, you know, most people aren't going to be immediately interested. So I think the important question is never to ask somebody what you do, but say, what are you working on now that you think has real potential? What are you working on now that has you most excited? What in your life has you most excited? So that you're hitting them on kind of an emotional level with a question that's not just related to the title that they have with their organization. So I think that sort of intrinsically sets up the situation to not be, to for you to think that people are not interesting who actually are interesting, and you don't know what a future path could be. So that's number one. But I think the other thing is that I just go to some of these events and I think, see, everybody is sort of pressured to feel like I've got to make a connection that's going to help me.
Yes.
So this is not contra Adrian, because I think the what can I do to help you is very a great question. And it's a particularly good question if you've asked the person, what are you doing now that excites you, as opposed to what do you do? So, but what I think.
I love that.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that the other thing is I go to those things to enjoy myself. And I want to enjoy myself. And I want to laugh and I want to have fun. And I find that attracts people. It attracts people because they see, you know, everybody's dutifully, I do this, I do that. Oh, well, I knew, did you know so-and-so? He worked at your company 40 years ago. Okay, fine. But if you're going there thinking, you know, I want to have fun, I want to have a few laughs, I want to have a conversation that's, you know, interesting and amusing, that's how you get to know people. That's how you attract people. That's my philosophy. And it's also the philosophy of me as an impatient person who doesn't like being in a lot of dull conversations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but very valuable. Thank you. And so you've created this network and you obviously start leveraging this network by by connecting with trusted people that, you know, they're probably with the same like-minded people, same wavelength. And then you group them into categories where I can, you know, these people I can relate to, I can network with, I can maybe ask them a few things like I did. You know, I watched your episode with C.B. Bowman, a great lady.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm going to say on air, thank you, C.B., for introducing me to Sally.
Thank you, C.B., for introducing me to Ellie.
She's a great networker and she's a giver, right? Yeah. And with these connections, you know, we get to meet together and we get to have this lovely conversation and share that with the rest of the audience, right? How wonderful this network, valuable network that we have created, right? So,
how wonderful it is. And, you know, that is, it's such a source of strength and support to have a good colleague network. And this is what, especially today, you know, jobs can be uncertain. Things don't necessarily last forever. And so the necessity of building your brand and keeping a good network of, you know, personal network, a tactical network that helps you do your work, a strategic network that helps you think about what's next, and being part of that for other people, being generous about it, as someone like CB and Marshall are,
always
looking to introduce you to other people. And it's not only helpful, it's extremely gratifying. You always have people run things by.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're coming to the end of our episode. And I normally end with an advice from you. And here we're going to focus a little bit on advice to women.
All right.
So if someone is listening and is unsure how to rise in their own path, what would you tell her?
I would tell her to really think very clearly, first of all, where we started off about what your mission is, because having a clear and distinctive mission is so important. It helps us make the right decisions, what opportunities to accept, what ones to turn down. So what the question around mission is really a question around intention. Mm. What do you intend to be your chief contribution to the world? That's the question.
Nice.
And when you can articulate that and get comfortable articulating that, so it's really specific, not like I seek to be an agent of transformation. That's so unspecific. No one knows what it means. And, you know, you'd feel embarrassed to say that to your best friend or something. I mean, it's not the way we talk in the world. But it was once you have that, and then you think, you know, what skills do I have that can help me do this? What are the skills? And then how can I talk about those skills? Where, how can I create opportunities? How can I do it in a way that intrigues people and makes them feel like, you know, that could be very interesting for what I'm doing, that kind of thing, so that you can kind of build things with them. And invest in your network. And don't feel, I think one thing women have gotten very hung up on, the idea that you need sponsors in order to succeed. They are hard to find. It's not just you. There are fewer sponsors than there are people seeking sponsors. So think in terms of your peer and your colleague network, if that's what's available to you, and then work with them in a way that where you're both leveraging that network.
Perfect advice. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Sally, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for bringing not just your wisdom, but your presence. And you spend your career helping others rise.
Yes.
But not giving them, I think, ladders, but by showing them what already is within reach, right? And in doing so, I think you redefine what leadership can look and feel like. So to everyone listening, if there's one thing to take from this conversation, it's this. Your voice matters. Your story is not too late. And your rise doesn't need permission. So if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to share it, spread the word, and subscribe. Catch a new guest and a new story every Thursday at 5 p.m. Dubai time, right here on Reimagining You. Until next time, keep rising. Thank you.